It is recording.
All right. Let's open our regular meeting of the North Bend Planning Commission for March 10th, 2016. First thing I'd like to do is welcome our newest member, Mary Miller, to our Planning Commission, and congratulations on your sentence or your dedication.
Thank you very much.
One thing that we've done in the past is introductions on the Planning Commission. While you might know some of us, I think it's good to go around, kind of start with what year you moved to town, any personal details you want to share, and maybe let's do your favorite thing of the community. I'll go first. So I moved to North Bend in 2003. I live in here with my wife, and we have two small kids, ages 3 and 5, soon to be 4 and 6. Favorite thing about our community, I'd say probably access to the trails. There's so much wilderness to just explore. It's something I enjoy. Elizabeth, I'm going to go next.
Do I need to say my name again? Elizabeth Hillersley.
Just make sure the story is the same as the last time you told us.
I first moved to North
You're
Bend.
You're asking me to be members. Yeah, I know. So, weird cross section of. I've been here full time since '96, but North Bend has been my permanent address from the day I was born, thanks to my dad's deciding to spend a career in the Army. And of course, coming back frequently to see family. Family's been here since the 40s, before there was a Silver Creek. There were younger slaves with their cows running through E.J. Roberts Park and hanging in places. So, what do I love about North Bend? You're making me pick one thing.
That's hard.
And I don't know that there is one thing. Except what encompasses it, which is a sense of community that sometimes gets a little strained here and there, but we seem to maintain it even with that. So that would be my favorite thing. That's where I've been.
Nice. Mr. Heller.
I'm Scott Heller. I was North Bend in 2012. Am I already on to the third one? What I like about North Bend, I mean, I'm definitely an outdoor kind of action sports kind of guy as far as skiing and mountain biking and hiking and mountaineering and all that stuff, all that fun stuff that ends with ING. And, you know, I like that North Bend's kind of on the edge of civilization, as my coworker said one time, and, you know, has mountains and rivers and lots of great places and lots of protected land. And so I think moving on a planning commission, I've learned more about the zoning and protected lands and can help guide kind of this as this city as it grows. And it's right in the middle of the situation. So.
Awesome. Thank you, Scott. Mr.
Lynch. I have to do the same thing. I have to keep my story straight. Been here since the late 90s, 87-ish. I got involved with the planning commission because I wanted to stay involved with what happens to the city, which is on the edge of things, and it'd kind of be nice to keep it that way, not ridiculously so. That was an exciting thing to be involved in. And favorite thing about North Bend, when you first asked the question, I said elk, because I think that symbolizes a lot of this valley's about, and if we keep it that way, they'll be strolling across the freeways for as long as we can think about it. Is that all three?
Yeah, and Jim, how long have you been on the Planning Commission?
That long? I don't remember when it started. When I started, I came straight from the parks. There was an overlay. I was in the Parks Commission first.
This is your third term, right?
I was going to say, it's got to be coming up on 7, 8, 9 years. Somebody help me.
I've been here 8 years now. I've been here on the Planning Commission as long as I've been
here.
So.
Yeah. So, it's been a great time.
Yeah.
And I'll keep showing up.
Elizabeth, you started last year in 2015. Scott, yeah. Also last year?
Yeah, last year. Mm-hmm.
2 years ago, I think.
Yeah, I think it's 2 years ago for me.
Wow, fantastic.
Yeah.
I thought you said longer than that last time. I mean, no, I'm having fun teasing you, right?
I think I started in 2011. Dick, you were...
I'm trying to think when I joined, but probably around 2013. Finished up a shy term and had my own term with that. Maybe 18? Or do I get out on 19?
How's that?
You term. Expire 18, I think.
That's expiration.
18. Yeah. In 2019.
Yeah.
But I haven't lived here very long. I worked here a long time, but I lived in the hills and commuted to the woods here for 27 years. But I've been involved in the community for a lot of years, as you know. But the thing I like about North Bend is if you want to make a difference, North Bend's the place to do it. You can join anything you want to join and be involved. It's so easy. You know, I come from big cities. You don't even try anymore. You just say, well, it's too big. I can't get anywhere. I can't get anything. But North Bend, you just step up. You just step up and you offer your time and your services and you do what you can. And when you want to move on, you move on. It is very comfortable in this town to work for something that is of importance to you. So I found myself on the Nick Huff's board for 24 years now. And Planning Commission, and Rotary, Rural Forest Commission, KCD now. I don't think I have room for any more. There's other new photography. Oh,
jump on in with the rest of everybody. Yeah. Okay.
Mary?
Yeah, well, this is just wonderful to be here again. And see, I've lived here since 1991. Two children. My daughter is 18 and graduating this year from outside. My son Jake is 22 and at Wazoo. He's an aerialist skier and he's broken many bones in his body. So my mom and me, which will never quit, is always kind of concerned there. I'm an avid outdoors woman. I love hiking. I look up at that mountain every day like most of us. I feel like I don't own it. None of us own it. It is part of the blessing of being here. So I respect this community so much. This area is vastly deserves our respect. So I love that. And community, definitely community. I'm an outgoing person. And I just jump out there and have a great time meeting people pretty much daily. And I just am kind of unafraid of any of that. It's very important to be who you need to be. So that's what I am.
Awesome. And it's been so nice to see you taking pictures of the community in the park
in
Meadowbrook and, doing those things.
It's a true honor. Documentation, that kind of photography, it's a very important aspect of, who I am in my career. And it's sharing that information, cataloging, if you will. Dave Batty, example A of being a great historian and a very valued member of the community that we really need. To not ignore our history. It's always in the making. Mm-hmm. So I intend on keeping doing that. I'll probably go up do some aerial shots towards when the weather breaks in June, May, and collect images for our valley like I have been doing for years. I think that could be a component that could help us determine some situations over time. Who knows? But I'm definitely open to it. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, everybody, for sharing a little bit. Mike, would you like to?
Sure, yeah. I've been living in the Valley since 1999. Moved here to take a job fresh out of college at the city of Snoqualmie. And got married in 2000. Janelle and I moved to Ethiopia in 2004. And we were very privileged to be able to come back to the Valley. And I got a job at City of North Bend in 2008. And we're very, very fortunate to be able to raise our kids here. And I think there's one thing that stands out to me as being the ideal thing about North Bend. It's all the interaction of relationship. So just an example on the Planning Commission. Here's my insurance agent that I'm serving as a Planning Commission member, and a friend that's taken our family photos that is now on the Planning Commission. And just all these little cross connections are just so rich and valuable in the Valley here.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay, well, next thing is our agenda, and anybody have any changes or move forward? So the first item on the agenda is to approve the minutes for February 11th, 2016. Do I have a motion?
Mm-hmm.
Motion by Mr. Wicke. Second?
I'll second.
Second by Ms. Gildersleeve.
With some arbitrary.
Any comments or changes or questions?
Discussion? I never say this, but I thought that the last meeting was particularly important. The minutes are so skimpy as of what went on.
In general minute taking, it's not to record every word of the meeting, but to record the actions and the motions taken. And so in that respect, the motion was won, and there were no other amendments. And so that's why they are so brief. And I think it's important that we always have available those recordings of the meeting where the content takes place.
And that's noted at the top of the minutes, that there's a complete recording available on the city website.
And no, that doesn't mean you don't say anything. I still think the written record should have word by word depth than what we do with it. If you want to get it word by word, great, important. So I just think that this particular meeting was a very big meeting. We're not done yet. We're still going to have a public hearing on this issue next city council. I think that our record is very limited. Our written record, that's all I'm saying. I'd like to see us be a little more sensitive to that. But in this case, I'll support the motion.
Okay. Well, thank you. And if there's a preference for any more detail, I think we can make that request, right, Mike, for a difference in the minutes. We can think about that if there's something, if it's on those heavily attended meetings where you're looking for those documentation points.
The ones that the public obviously thought were important enough to attend.
Okay.
Those are the ones that seem to not do very well on recording.
Okay. So I don't know, Mike, if you want to...
I'll carry the message forward.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So we have a motion and a second. All those in favor of approving the minutes for February 11th, 2016, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion is unanimous. The minutes are approved. Next item on the agenda is public comment on non-agenda items. Seeing no one from the public, we will move forward to item number 4, which is the introduction to the amendments to North Bend Municipal Code Chapters 12.08, 19.06, and 19.07 pertaining to the installation of franchise utility facilities. Mike, you handed us an updated...
I did. So that is in the packet that went out to the Planning Commission electronically. We left out the triggers for the requirements for when overhead utility lines have to be underground because we wanted to discuss that further internally. We've since resolved that, and so that's in the handed out copy that you have.
Okay. Thank you for that update. And then you want to continue on with your regular introduction?
Sure, yeah. So this is the intent here is to simplify and clarify. We've got 3 code sections right now that address similar utility provisions. And there's conflicting language. It's unclear between 2 code sections whether or not undergrounding is required and in what circumstances. And we're also in the process of creating some public work standards for all of our utilities, anything having to do with installation of roads, streets, utilities, etc. Those are detail-oriented standards that won't be coming before the Planning Commission because of what they deal with. They deal with what type of bolt needs to be placed in this certain
They're space. More engineering.
Yeah. But at the same time that we're doing that, we want to make sure that we're updating our regulations to reference to those standards and to make sure that they're consistent in what we want to address at the larger level. So the undergrounding provisions, we've clarified when undergrounding is required in certain circumstances. We've exempted when there's less than 150 feet of street frontage and you're not affecting the existing overhead wiring, then you can leave it alone, because otherwise it's cost prohibitive for somebody that's got a fairly small lot, fairly low value project to have to take
to relocate those utilities, take down the poles, put it under the sidewalk, rip up the sidewalk, et cetera.
And, Mike, are you talking in the case where it would be a private individual or a small plat development where there's low frontage?
A plat requires it.
Even if it's under 4?
Well, if it's less than 150 feet in width, then it's possible it could fit under the exemption.
So that has nothing to do with the other instance where the city is redoing a street?
Yeah, that's another section. So that's another part that we clarified, and that is section C, 1906-060C. I'm sorry, not C. B. And that clarifies that it is required that they go underground except when exempted by the action of the city council. So there's going to be circumstances where it's not practical or not desirable to underground the utilities. And rather than trying to provide a huge amount of regulation describing exactly when that should happen, providing an out by the city council will allow the council to discuss options, staff can provide recommendations, and then council can take action on whether they want to exempt the undergrounding requirement.
One would be before you have a shallow water table, I imagine.
Yeah, that's one circumstance. There's another circumstance, as an example, right now we're doing a Safe Routes to Schools grant to do some shoulder improvements, possibly some sidewalk improvements along Stilson to provide better connectivity for pedestrians getting to Opstead Elementary School. But because of the nature of that, it's a relatively small project, not a lot of value with it. It's not a part of a larger project. It wouldn't make sense necessarily to underground in that circumstance. But again, instead of providing every possible scenario in a prescriptive regulation, we're just making a statement that the council can exempt it. But that still requires council action, so it requires kind of a public discussion and staff recommendation.
Okay. Anything else?
Yeah, so other things, lighting, street lighting right now, we don't have anything that says when it's actually required, so that's been a little bit of a black hole. And the current standard actually states that the minimum street lighting required is 0.4 foot candles. And so that presumes in all circumstances on all streets throughout all development, that's not necessarily desirable in all circumstances. We've heard a lot from the community about rural character and trying to preserve night sky. So providing a uniform 0.4 throughout a development is going to make it look much more suburban, more developed. And so instead of that, what we've provided in the draft here is that street lighting is provided at all intersections, at street ends, and at corners. And other than that, it could be left dark. But it also provides that the public works director has the authority to increase lighting levels wherever necessary for public safety.
Mike, is street lighting in another section that details anything other about light pollution or types of lighting or focused lighting? Or is this going to be the only section?
This is the only section for public street lighting.
Okay.
We've got an entirely different section for site lighting. So that's your parking lots, your pathways, building lighting, et cetera. And that has got similar standards to this in that it requires full cutoff fixtures. That's another thing in here. We're proposing that fixtures be full cutoff, which means that you've got the bottom of the light fixture and the bulb actually sits up within it so that the light doesn't go outward, it just goes down. Also similar is that it prescribes maximum foot candles to prevent glare. And make those.
Mike, have you asked the police department to inform you on the safety issues of the lighting standards?
We have not yet.
Are you going to?
We can do that, yeah.
Well, they'd have an opinion, I'm sure, about whether or not we have enough lighting in the streets for public safety. What do you think?
We can certainly ask them. That this, again, provides that these are the minimum standards, and the public works director can go anything over the minimum standards. We can certainly, that's a good idea, we should consult with the police. And
just other people, I'm just suggesting you might want to talk to them in terms of just the safety component for street lighting. Mm-hmm.
Isn't there I'm just thinking there's got to be the planning slash engineering standard
cars don't change across the country. The width of intersections is pretty much the same. People don't walk much faster or slower. Isn't there some, every intersection is this sort of for safety?
Yeah, and that's where we also did increase beyond the 4 foot candles. Right now it's 4 throughout. And we've increased that to 0.6 on arterial streets.
So there's a standard that's, where would you get it from? What's the source?
I don't know. What source would be. This came from a consultant that was working on our public works standards.
Okay.
So we've since modified it, but that 0.4 and 0.6 came from the consultant.
Like if you go through Snoqualmie, for example, would you say that's what is in the plan as far as intersection lighting? Match up?
It's depending on the context. So downtown Snoqualmie, I really don't know whether their new street lights, what that would be.
I'm just trying to put it in.
Yeah.
Other than, you know, pioneering it. It's probably pretty easy.
I think 0.4 would be typical to a street light in a residential subdivision.
Okay.
And then the only difference is how frequent you see a street light.
And if you use what I always come back to when I hear lights, that probably a grant got involved and messed us up, but the street on, it continues on past Park alongside QFC?
Downing, yeah.
Downing. What was the scenario there that got those lights to be the way they are?
Yeah, so that is in our downtown commercial zone. A while back, somebody had determined that that was the particular type of light pole and light fixture that would go throughout the downtown to make it uniform aesthetically. And so that street was designed with the same fixtures as what the rest of the streets have been done. And from what I understand, that those particular types of light fixtures are much brighter when they're new than 5 or 10 years later. Hmm. So I think they're probably starting to mellow out now, but they are, they've been referred to as the
blue balls. Still read.
Yeah.
Still read.
But Bartels is an example of what you'd see beyond our downtown core with new street projects. So that's the LED bulb, that's a full cutoff fixture within the surround of the light fixture.
I think of Kirkland when I bring this up, and I'm sure there's better technology than when they first did it. But at certain crosswalks, there is a signal that can be pushed, and not just enter the crosswalk, but there's actually a light in the road that brightens up so that it can't be missed, even if the pedestrian's not there anymore.
One on Westlake Savannah.
Yeah, I wonder what that would do to our scenario about trying to light the intersection, because if you're taking care of the pedestrians, which is the main focus probably there, especially on the way to school, that sort of lighting would do more, I think, than just making it daylight at the intersection, like, for safety-wise.
Yeah.
I don't know, I'm just talking.
Yeah,
where this stuff fits
technology
in.
Will continue to change, and I think we'll want to be adaptive to that.
LED stuff's real cheap.
LED, that's a good reminder. We were talking among staff, and we wanted to provide another standard in here that says LED or other best available technology to reduce energy consumption shall be used. We felt that was important, but not to specify exactly LED because technology changes so fast. Our current standards that we're replacing in this call for mercury vapor street lights. Mercury vapor was a technology about 30 years ago, right? Mm-hmm. The blue-white light.
Yep.
And then we moved to sodium vapor about 20 years ago, and now on to LED. So it will continue to change. So we don't want to lock ourselves into LED,
right?
Have some kind of language about or other appropriate technology. So I will make a note to myself and make that addition so that you'll see that in the draft at your next meeting.
You could say something like lowest energy usage.
Yeah.
That's what you're driving at.
Yeah, I don't know if it's worth saying it now, maybe, but there's a tendency, it's kind of like we take the kids hiking, like everybody's taking their kids out in the woods. As soon as it gets dark, they're all looking for their flashlights. Until you say, all right, look at your watch, or here's the time. Don't show me your phone because you got a flashlight there too, by the way. Count to 15 minutes, and then you'll be able to see again. So the neighborhoods, you drive through the neighborhoods, and kids all over the place grow up and then never see the sky because it's never dark, wherever they are.
I kind of want to push back as any chance we can. Interest of safety, sure, but let's not brighten the sky when we don't need to.
On a just more home kind of consideration, I notice that most people on their outdoor lights in their house, mine included, is a light that just has glass around the bulb and it just shoots straight out. Mm-hmm. And so there's like this dark sky initiative kind of thing, and you can, it's just a simple overhanging light that it, and it, and the bulb kind of sits up in there and the light goes down, not yeah. out, you know. So, and then like the Tannerwood homes, I've noticed they, on their garage, they have like a little soffit kind of thing, and they have some lights in there, and the light just goes down. So that's just the kind of thing I think as a town, you know, we can do this for the city, the street lighting and stuff, but if the housing development emphasizes lights, that the house lights, if that can be a spec in there or something, you know,
yeah.
that, maybe it is, but a lot of people's existing lights actually shoot out and just blind you if you go around at night. Mm-hmm. Anyway, as I've learned how bad my own house is, I'm like, all right, I got to get that changed out. So
it's pretty clear, you know, where they're talking about intersections, dead-end streets, and crosswalks. But there isn't really a mention of what Scott's talking about is just your average, you know, street in a development.
So yeah, so that, again, this is just addressing things that happen within the right-of-way. So we do have our off-site lighting standards as well, or your off-street lighting standards that apply. It doesn't apply to residential development other than a multifamily residential project. But that, otherwise, for multifamily and commercial, it does require the full cutoff that you're talking about. So our residential design standards would need to be amended to also require that for residential if that was something that the community desired.
So does that help you?
Yeah, I think it's just something to consider, as Jim's saying, you know. It's just, yeah, reducing all of that light pollution, I think.
Yeah, I think it's a subtle, I think the average Joe and Sally, in fact, you just made the case, you don't really notice it.
No.
You get used to not seeing what you can't see. And I just think of it as, you know, get off the freeway and get past the shops, then it ought to go dark for the most part, so that people can enjoy the night.
And it's consistent with what we're trying to maintain here, the feeling that you're living in the mountains, yep. and that you're a rural community, not in the middle of downtown Bellevue.
Yeah. And I'm a simple voice against that because I do have concerns about people looking around property where they don't belong. You know, I'm a big lot, but I have an acre, and I keep a lot of it lit up at night. I sure must have off when I go to bed, but when I'm awake, I like to be able to feel like I'm safe where I'm at. And, I understand about light pollution, but I also understand about the risks of not showing any concern about your safety. I think people will take advantage of that. So it sounds idyllic to want to have a bright sky at night, but I think where you have a lot of people, I don't think we can play games with that. I think camping and all that kind of stuff, you can get out there pretty quick and see a pretty bright sky and just
So to be clear, there's a couple of things. One's private lighting on a house versus public lighting on the street. And so what we're talking about is the street lighting, mm-hmm. not public lighting. So in that case, you know, you can light your house. As far as going on the street, you mentioned some other section.
Yeah, we also have our design standards that require more lighting in certain areas. In the downtown, on what we call Class 1 and Class 2 pedestrian streets, there's additional lighting requirements. So this is really talking about when you're getting out away from the center of the town.
Yeah. You know what drives me nuts is the new headlights on vehicles. They're so bright. They're so unnecessarily bright. They just drive me crazy. Why, when I try and tap my brights on, they come with the brighter lights. My God. You know, this is bright, buddy. This is bright. You know, and feel that, brother.
But, well, so you're
downtown.
That's why the paint peels. Yeah. That's why the paint on your head puts peel.
So I don't know. I'm not the only people. I'm not the only lights to be lit up. There's an extreme there. I understand that.
Mr. McCarty, do you have more for your introduction, or?
I think that's basically it. Otherwise, it's just trying to simplify where we don't need to have too much specification and resolve the conflicting language between the different code sections.
So then I will first start with Commissioner Lecky. Since I've been on this planning commission, there have been two prominent things that you've talked about, property owner rights and underground fires.
Yep. Plus elk. Don't forget the elk.
Is this not making you happy to see this move?
Yeah, I want to make. I was just going to come back to the underground. The exemptions that exist, whether it's because it's the size of the lot or the size of development. By the way, I think I just do the math. Three lots is a cutoff. 50 feet a lot. So there ought to be something, some kind of provision, either, you know, a bond kind of circumstance or whatever, so that that little gap doesn't stop the next level of progress to get the power underground. I don't know how to do that exactly, but I defer to your expertise. There's got to be a way to kind of push back in every case, because it's the same thing. If you don't connect the road, then there won't be a road after where you stop, right?
So this is just
up and down through
yeah,
the whole place.
It's just when it's existing overhead. So you have to bring it down unless you're in that circumstance of existing overhead and you've got less than 150 feet. So I don't think that you're going to see a lot of ups and downs.
So if a development has a 50-foot wide or 150-foot wide access to the development, power line goes straight through the entrance,
or it goes to there,
overhead,
and then it's underground?
It's just about the frontage, so the piece of the right-of-way that directly abuts the development, if that's greater than 150 feet, or the frontage that contains that particular utility.
Okay.
So if we look at Tannerwood, it's a recent development. They have a line that runs to there, but everything inside the development is underground.
Yeah.
How does that compare to these standards?
So this would require them, if they exceed 150 feet, which they probably do, to have brought that overhead line underground.
Okay. I don't know if it's temporary or it's permanent, but that's just one example.
I get inside the plat. I get inside, inside the neighborhood that's being built. But what about the land across their frontage?
That's what this is addressing.
So
if their access point is three lots wide, they're building there, they're just driving people through that point, what happens to the overhead line that used to go
then it can stay if they don't have to touch it.
So what Jim is wondering is, can they pay a fee into an account or something so when the rest of it gets developed around them, it can move underground for everybody?
Well, like a sidewalk circumstance. I mean, you can't. That same developer might have to put a sidewalk if there doesn't one exist at the time they want to do development. They might bring the sidewalk all across their whole frontage. It should be the same thing with all the utilities. Agreed?
Well, the challenge is the light pole or telephone poles. I don't remember what the exact distance is. It's generally bigger than 150 feet from pole to pole. And so if you've got less than 150 feet and your poles are not, you can't underground them, you'd have to go quite a ways beyond the site itself and do extra work beyond, which gets to be very expensive.
Yes, but expense issue, it seems to me that we can all be in agreement that when you go underground, property values go up, being taxes go up, being costs can be met. So it seems to me if it's an aesthetic situation where you have property values rising because you have minimum overheads, would that be a factor in your decision that you're actually improving your tax base?
It certainly does, but we're also trying to look at the other end of the spectrum where it's just a simple, somebody wants to build one house on their lot, and it would cost $250,000 to underground those utilities.
So what about that 150-foot wide exemption that we just require that they put the conduit in.
That's a good idea. That's a really good idea, because that way when it does happen, it's ready to go.
Because if we don't do something on a grand scale, it's never going to happen. Because the minute that development goes in and there's 150 houses that drove in that 150-foot wide access point, they don't care. And they would never cough up another cent to deal with power overhead because they're used to it. They've been driving under it every day. It's not in the neighborhood. It's in their access.
I think we actually might be talking about two different things, though. Because if we do have that one individual who is going to take their vacant lot and build one house on it, and they're under that 150, are we then going to require them to do the same thing and put in a conduit versus someone who that's an access point into a larger acreage with a greater number of units? And is there a way to dice that to further kind of bring down that? If it's 150 feet and the total amount being developed exceeds this amount, they still have to do the...
Yeah, so it's, what we can do is tie it to street frontage improvements. So that's when the developer has to do sidewalks or better. That's based on 50% when the improvements are worth more than 50% of the existing value of the improvements. Okay. So if we tie it in with street frontage, then it's, you're doing street frontage anyway, you're having to rip up the sidewalks and rebuild it, put in the conduit at the same time.
Right. So I think that's kind of already done in the, what you call it, arterial roadways. There's already that when there's a cross street developed, city street. Isn't that already, there's conduit already in place?
It depends on the circumstance.
I talked to Mark Rigos today about underground utilities. And he told me that there might be some conduit that has already been put down. However, he's not sure of the quality of the mapping and
sure. Or the material is in the ground from how many years ago. But if the space is there, it's easy to prepare it versus having to dig under.
But he's been told that there is existing conduit underground to run the utilities.
It's almost like if we take the conduit conversation and apply it, it'll be much easier for the power to follow. Mm-hmm. Eventually we'll have, there's only 20 feet here that doesn't have conduit. And at the end of the line, somebody's doing the development, and we can say, okay, here we're going to go from point to point.
And Mike, I didn't see anything in here about transmission lines.
Transmission lines are in a different category. So that we probably should clarify that as well.
But or make mention of where they're...
Yeah.
Covered.
Yeah, this is distribution.
You mean like Bonneville Power?
Right? Yeah, the real big towers.
Or just Tanner Electric transmission lines or PSE transmission lines that might run. From what Mark said, they run really hot, and it's like $1 million every quarter mile or something because they have to install cooling units.
Right now, the poles carry power on the top and then usually some kind of communications on the next two or one, cable and phone or both together. And so, back to the conduit story, it needs to have allocation for three separate services. Mm-hmm. Assuming we're going to continue to use phones.
Well, internet.
There's always a need for conduit.
Yes, right.
And just a note for clarification for you all, too. This is the introduction to this. We're also sending this out to Comcast, Puget Sound Energy, Tanner Electric, et cetera. And we expect to get feedback from them as well that we'll put into the update.
Yeah, we've got a customer friendly with our design because they won't see it. Unless there's certain requirements that they have to maintain the license in all communities.
Mike, how different is this than, I guess, Issaquah or Wyoming?
Yeah, we went through looking at a number of cities, and there's a lot of similarities. There's different ways that cities address the undergrounding requirement. Some base it on an evaluation. Some base it on a width. Some just say it's going to be underground no matter what. Some don't require it at all. So it's just kind of figuring out what's the right particular standard for our community.
And do you recall who is just underground no matter what?
I don't think I brought the file with me.
Probably some Amish.
Sounds like a Des Moines to me.
Who else has questions?
I was actually more about a section I noticed missing, and I'm assuming there's a reason. When I was kind of comparing what we're condensing, I noticed the section on the overhead utility lines. The transfer over kind of stops with the 12.08040, and then the entire section that starts with the 12.08050 right to receive services on down, it doesn't get mirrored.
Yeah, we just, that's again trying to consolidate, and we didn't feel like that was necessary language, that it would be worked out.
So is it handled elsewhere? Because some of this is laying out the city's authority to disconnect and so on.
And that's not the city's authority. That's one of the reasons we got rid of that. That's
perfect. That's what I wanted to know. I thought that was likely it, but I wanted to clarify.
Good question. So how does this... You mentioned reaching out to Puget Sound and others. It seems to me fairly unique. It kind of fits with the rest of our small city that we have this electrical, we have like Prior Tanner with his own agreement with, I'm assuming, with Bonneville. Are they given any preferential focus because they are part of the city, they're local versus, I'm not sure I asked this question any better than that. It's kind of like keeping them in the family, so to speak.
Does a smaller provider get any different standard or?
No, we haven't considered that.
Because the alternative really is they get pushed out. They provide what they provide and as growth happens.
Well, they wouldn't get pushed out. They would pass on whatever extra costs underground to the consumer. It's ultimately the developer that would be responsible.
I guess I'm thinking, without knowing and looking at where the grids lay out in the streets, where Tanner ends and Puget Sound Energy begins, but as development and growth goes on, the connectivity between the street, wherever the power is in the street or up above the street, I'm just thinking it would be somehow beneficial to us as a city to continue what Tanner's doing, which is keeping it local.
Well, they have service area boundaries. So Puget Sound Energy serves certain customers, and Tanner serves certain customers, and they have an agreement on what those areas are. It's not a nice, easy Tanner Electric
right.
PSC. There's
how does that get set up?
I really don't know.
Maybe that's a homework assignment for this weekend.
That's the state.
I think probably the utility
political at some level. Sure.
But the city doesn't get involved in that. That's just the utility providers that.
You better talk to Steve Walker, Tanner. We're going to come to a meeting and talk to us about Tanner Electric.
We had a lot of conversations with them back when the whole electric vehicle stations, when that was being talked about. Seem to be kind of forgotten about. I know we've got a few in place, but there was talk about every gas station having one of those facilities, and Tanner was on board to make it happen. I don't know where it ended up. I just think you get, as a city, you get more attention from a local provider than you will from, you know, it's kind of like the garbage collection story.
Yeah, but again, I don't think we have the authority to say we would like to see this area served by Tanner Electric. That's out of the
No, I understand that. I'm just putting it out there. Maybe to stir something up. That's the other thing I like to do, Gary.
Mm-hmm. I will say that the electric charging station behind the house in Snoqualmie is in high demand. You have people that park there and wait for their chance to use it.
Well, there are some new ones at the Outlet Mall.
Yeah, that's the Outlet Mall.
Yeah.
Has Tesla done their own? I've seen it in Fife down south.
They did it in Fife corridor.
Say again?
They did the I-5 corridor.
Yeah.
And you presented it to the Planning Commission that I guess we were recognized, since we were on the I-90 corridor, that we were a priority city to get that implemented.
Yeah, we adopted our amendments and those are in code, yeah.
Okay. Back to our update. Any other points you want to make?
Can I answer my question?
I brought the Touring tonight, by the way, that has the Bi-Xenon headlights. But when I put my brights on, it doesn't get any brighter. It just gets wider.
Well, yeah, the asphalt smokes.
Any other points, Mr. Ryan?
No, this has been a good discussion, in my opinion.
Mr. Heller, any questions? I'll just say, I talked with Mark, and my biggest question was on the requirements in relocating the wires. And the biggest question I didn't understand was the relocation of the poles. And if you drive around town and you notice how poles are set back a little bit further away to provide for either width of street changes or sidewalk improvements, the instance where a pole movement would be required is pretty slim. And when you're required to move a pole is the only time where the utility would have to pay some fee. What he said was, and correct me if I'm wrong, there's a state fund or state law that requires this when you move lines that they relocate their wires.
Yeah, the utility provider do it. Yeah.
Now, if you're not moving poles and the city wants the lines underground, then the city would front that cost.
If it's a city project.
Yeah. So those are the kind of points that I was wondering. Other than that, any other final questions or asks?
Kind of an interesting question, hopefully. It's got something to do with lighting, but the Bartels location where that big pole went up, it's so stridently different looking than any other pole there. There's got to be a story to that.
I think it has to do with the buttressing, mm-hmm. because there's a lot of tension on it.
Okay.
It's apparently in quite a distance from other poles, and there's a lot of weight on that particular pole, so it's that blue lamb type of pole for extra strength.
Okay.
It was extremely expensive.
It looks like it could have been
a
monumental design.
It was kind of $100,000 for the
pole. Wow.
Yeah.
Who paid for that?
The developer.
Okay, so that's Tom.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh. Yeah, talk to him about that one.
Okay, that's not, that's okay. I was just very curious. I've been just curious about that. Thank you.
I've seen another one. I was assuming, otherwise you'd have to make it a lot taller to have the same strength.
Maybe.
I don't know.
Somebody needs to be putting some spar runners on that thing. I mean, it's beautiful wood.
Yeah.
Okay. So I have down on my list, Mike, feedback from police department on lighting preferences or asks to put in some wording for the lower energy usage versus type of bulbs, requiring conduit for properties that have less than 150 foot of frontage, and also that you'll get some feedback from the utilities. Does that sound right?
Yeah, and some language differentiating between transmission and distribution lines.
Awesome. Okay, good to the order.
I didn't really hear what happened with the truck town and the recommendation to, I guess, about permanent regulations. It went to the city council and then...
It went to a work study, and according to Jenna, there was something that is preventing them from bringing it to the city council meeting on Tuesday. And so they're going to pass another moratorium, which is about to expire. And I don't remember what the reason was, why they're not discussing it on Tuesday.
The reason was with every development regulation that we bring forward has to go to the Department of Commerce for review and comment. Mm-hmm. And we have requested an expedited review, which you can think gets them to speed up their review and comment, otherwise it's 60 days. They did not accept our request for expedited review. So therefore, we're beyond the time frame of the interim regulation, the moratorium, and we need to then renew the moratorium, unfortunately, even though it's just a very short amount of time, and therefore couldn't take action on it.
And so this was a process I didn't know existed, that the changes go to the Department of Commerce. And
isn't there a limit? Like there's only, we've just burned our last extension on that?
No, no, there's, you're talking about the request, oh, the moratorium.
6 months, right?
You can extend it for 6 months, and you're not supposed to continue to do that. Yeah.
No.
But the purpose in this case is just to allow time for Commerce to provide comment back.
Right.
There's something like a 8 days difference between the time when the current moratorium expires and when she expected the feedback to come back, and then they have to schedule for the meeting. So,
my sense of it, that's not necessarily. They're probably being asked to take this position. They've been careful to supply our need, but right now I think they're taking an opposing position. So, I don't know.
The Congress.
Are you referring to politics?
I think they're pushing back for some reason.
That's what I was just wondering if it was, if you.
Well, yeah, Department of Transportation specifically requested Commerce not extend or not provide an expedited review. So they, I'm assuming, will be providing comments to the city.
Okay. To be continued.
Okay. Thank you, Scott. Anybody else? Go to the order of administrative items.
Do we have any permits approved that don't sound like they're actually going to be built?
Permits, development projects?
I'm just trying to get a read because we've had a kind of a rule flurry in the last 18 months of plats approved, building permits pulled, bang, 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 stuff sold. I'm just trying to.
But very low actual permits.
There's always a lag time. So it's like always an example. They got preliminary plat approval a year ago. They haven't come in for engineering yet, presuming they're just looking for the right buyer of the property. I would assume that everything that's been through preliminary plat approval will get developed, and it's just a matter of when they break ground on it.
So if they're vested at preliminary, how long is that good for?
They have 5 years.
Okay.
Has there been anyone coming in and asking questions about the property adjacent to E.J. Roberts Park that's pending right now?
Just telephone inquiries. We haven't had a pre-application review.
Many people are going to be surprised when they realize how much of what they thought was E.J. Roberts Park.
So that's a piece of land with a house on it.
And it runs all the way back to what is now the Pulte property.
A bigger parcel?
Okay. From 6th Street back up against the Pulte property. Mm-hmm. And there are many people who have casually used the back portion of that property for years as though it was an extension of E.J. Roberts Park. Mm-hmm. And may not realize that it's not part of.
There's a rough little trail.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Adverse position.
Yeah. You better get something about
that. Oh, I kept hoping some angel investor is going to buy it and donate it to the city, but you know, that kind of thing doesn't work.
There are quite a few critical areas back there, too, so that's not going to be fully built out.
So, Mike, you mentioned sidewalks or walkability to Opstead Elementary. There's new sidewalk that leads to side view from the roundabout. Mm-hmm. Is that part of that overall project?
No, that was totally different funds. So that was where council had said this is a priority for us to improve pedestrian safety here. So council just funded that on their own.
Okay. Is there any plans to continue down to like La Forest Homes or?
Not at this point. No.
Okay.
As development occurs, that'll continue the sidewalk. So that. You were asking earlier about, somebody was asking about Mountain View Estates. That's kind of the next stretch beyond the Sideview neighborhood, and so that will continue sidewalks off to Maloney Grove, and then as development occurs further down Cedar Falls, then sidewalks are required.
Okay. I and Jim attended the short course on local planning in Bellevue, and have to say my second time through was much better than the first time and got more out of it. But if you haven't taken that training yet, then there's online videos, or you can go to one of the other classes that's being held somewhere around Washington State. There's also the Open Public Meetings Record Act that if you haven't gone to training, it's supposed to be now completed within your first 90 days. So I provided that to Mike, and I guess our city clerk, Susie Oppendahl, will send out some message to everybody about that. Very helpful information. Our last meeting talked about our travel centers. And I just wanted to say thank you very much to this commission for their thoughtful points, all the deliberation that we had and the quality of discussion. It truly makes me proud to serve with you guys because of the dedication, the thoughtfulness that you showed. So I just wanted to say again, thank you very much for what you did and how you conducted that. It was very well done. So, with that, motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Motion by Mr. Lucky, second.
Second.
Second by Commissioner Miller.
I want to leave. I want to stay.
All those in favor of adjourning the meeting, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The meeting is adjourned at 7:56.
That's live.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.